Works, Finance, and Audit Committee. I see we have Diane here. Any other board members present?
I don't believe so.
We may have others come in. First on the agenda is the pension and audit reports.
Yeah, Joel, if I might just kick this off real quick, we're going to have Kristen Hughes from RSM is going to walk us through the Waterworks, Des Moines Waterworks audit reports and also the Des Moines Waterworks pension audit reports today. I think you will find that we have unqualified audits in both cases, but we will let Kristen confirm that. And I think, Kristen, I'll just go ahead and hand it to you right there. And you can, we can do the screen sharing swap here if Michelle will unshare, and then Greg can share the document and we can walk through.
Perfect. All right. Thank you. While Greg's pulling it up, as Tim mentioned, we're going to go through the documents here in this packet. I'm going to go through a lot of the content we've usually gone through in the past. I'm trying to highlight, hopefully, the meaningful areas in the financials. Please don't hesitate to interrupt. I'll certainly leave time for questions at the end. But if something comes up on a certain page, please don't hesitate to interrupt me as we go through these in real time. So starting with the financials, as Ted mentioned, Greg, if you wouldn't mind going ahead and moving down to the audit opinion. These are still in draft form, consistent with prior years. Usually we wait until the committee approves at today's meeting, and then we finalize these, assuming no changes. So this is in draft form, but you will see that it currently shows an unmodified opinion, which is the AICPA terminology, or more commonly known as a clean audit opinion, meaning the financials are presented in accordance with GAAP as required with no material modifications. Next, after that, you will see, I won't go through this in detail, but moving through the couple versions of the audit opinion there, you will see management's discussion and analysis. Thank you, Greg. So management's discussion and analysis is where management has the opportunity to provide a narrative. So this is an unaudited section, just simply because, like I said, it is a narrative where management goes through and analyzes and provides a discussion on really comparing the 2020 results to 2019. So going through and highlighting any areas that had significant fluctuations on either the balance sheet or the income statement side. So I always encourage people, hopefully if you don't have time to read the full report, this is a really good, but at least shorter summary that highlights any significant changes in the current year. So moving down to the statement, your comparative statement of net position, which is your balance sheet. While Greg gets there, it's page 15 of the report. So here again is the statements of net position or the balance sheet. You will see here, so total current assets, the $43 million. I usually just kind of highlight significant areas here that might have modified from prior year. So you will see total current assets increased approximately $17 million or 63%. Most of this relates to just an increase in cash, both in the general account, operating reserve, and now there is an investing operating account. So you're going to see that current assets increased compared to prior year as a result of those areas. In the non-current asset section, no significant changes. You will see that capital assets net, that line item, increased about $10 million. You know, again, that's on a $370 million balance. But capital assets increased this year, again, just due to continued acquisitions, construction, et cetera, in those areas for capital projects. Deferred outflows, these primarily relate to pension and OPEB areas. Slight increase here. These are just timing issues, differences between your actuarial results and final, and they put them in this category called deferred outflows and inflows to methodically recognize fluctuations over a smooth basis versus year over year. So these are just simply timing and recognition areas related to your plans. Moving down to the liability side. So total current liabilities increased just shy of $3.5 million or 16%. You'll see the two primary areas that increased are accounts payable and construction payable. Payables are going to simply, again, be timing issues. It really just depends on the timing of the invoices you receive from your vendors, if they were paid before year end versus not. So that's pretty standard to see fluctuations in those payable categories. In the non-current liability section, you'll see obviously your long-term debt balance continues to go down as you make your scheduled principal payments. slightly offsetting that is your total OPEB liability this year did increase. There was a couple of assumption changes made by the actuary, most notably just your discount rate. You're required to change that each year at December 31st. So the liability went up just a result of the market's discount rates going down at year end. Moving on to page 17, this is your comparative income statement. So you'll see total operating revenue increased about $7 million or 10%, as discussed in MD&A. This is primarily, obviously, in the water sales category. Water consumption in 2020 was up about 9%. So rate changes, I think, was pretty moderate. There was an increase in the late spring, but really most of the increase was due to actual consumption increase in the current year. Operating expenses were pretty consistent year over year. Really, the most notable area is labor. And as discussed again in MD&A, most of that I think is going to be linked to, obviously, in the early stages of COVID when you had to do your sequestering period of the water department personnel, there was increased labor costs as a result of that, you know, overtime paying that those costs. So overall, operating expenses were pretty consistent year over year with the, that in consideration.
Kristen, is there a easy explanation for the decrease in retirement benefits?
I can let Michelle speak to that. That doesn't necessarily represent contributions per se going down. Again, there might be a lot of pieces getting captured in the actuarial recognition of timing. So like I said, I can let Michelle or Amy speak to that. It's unlikely it's contributions to either plan. It's more likely financial reporting amortization of those costs.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's the, when she talked about the deferred inflows and deferred outflows changes, and then even the obligation for the OPEB plan. So that all flows in through that retirement benefit expense line.
Thank you.
Yep. Page 18, cash flows. I won't spend significant time on this. I mean, you will see in the top category net cash provided by operating activities. So you know, it's good to know as an enterprise fund that operates, you know, based on charging user rates, et cetera, that a positive cash flow balance is generated by the operating activity in the system. So moving on to page 20, I'll go through this a little quickly just because we'll go through the separate pension report as well. But the pension plan is shown as a what's called a fiduciary trust fund in the Des Moines Water Works report. So here you'll see the pension balance in the assets in the trust year over year increased about $5 million. The next page, 21, this is the income statement for the pension plan. So that's going to show the why for the increase. You'll see that in a pension plan, there's really two areas of additions, employer contributions into the plan and investment activity. So you'll see contributions were consistent year over year. Investment income was a positive result, almost $7 million. You will see that was a little less than what was earned in 2019, though. And then the outflow, obviously, in a plan is going to be substantially your benefit payments to retirees with a small amount of admin expenses. So you'll see there that benefit payments out to the retirees was pretty consistent year over year. So overall, here is, again, this $5 million increase in the pension trust, really the net effect of those kind of three primary areas. So moving into the footnotes, Greg, if you want to go ahead and start scrolling, I don't spend too much time. If you want to maybe get me down to page 27, please. Footnote one that Greg's going through right now, I don't usually spend too much time here. This is a required accounting disclosure. So it's always called the summary of significant accounting policies. All entities are required to provide detailed disclosures on the nature of the business and how they account for things. So no significant changes there from what you would have seen in the prior year. Footnote two here that Greg has put us on, cash and investments. So the GASB, of course, requires just disclosures around what entities are invested in. As you can see here, you all have historically invested in the U.S. Treasury note bonds. So pretty straightforward as far as the type of investment that you would fair value, et cetera. So again, just summarizing the investments that you hold at your end, you've addressed the required disclosures that they require in risk areas, meaning what is the credit rating on those? How long do you hold them to maturity? Therefore, how subject are they to interest rate fluctuations in the market, et cetera? So then on page, at the bottom of page 28, and then where Greg is, you also do show the investment activity specifically for your pension plan as well. So this $61 million of investments here, This is specific to the investments that are held by principal in your pension trust fund. So moving on to page 31, I won't go through this in detail, but you know, just when you think about what information financials here is a detailed roll forward, this is how it's required to be presented in your report, but capital assets. So this just shows capital assets held in the prior year and then the activity that occurred. So you can always look here to see how much did you all spend in capital, either construction in progress or just actual depreciable assets that were purchased, how many were retired, et cetera. Moving on to note 4 on the next page, this is your non-current liabilities. So at the top here, you'll see, first of all, your bonded debt, the series of water revenue bonds that are outstanding from the 2003 series, which is almost done, and then the 2012 series that you have. Also captured in this footnote, I won't go through it because there's separate footnotes, but again, that net pension liability and OPEB liability are considered the long-term or non-current liabilities on your financials. So in the rest of footnote 4, this again is just required disclosures that you have around debt. So you show, you provide information on the maturity schedule so people have context on how much you owe in debt service each year, both an annual principal and interest payment. So moving on to page 35, please, Greg, at the start of note 5. You provide detailed information on both of your retirement plans. So again, obviously Des Moines Water Works has its standalone pension plan that was frozen a few years ago, and then your participation in IBERS. So here you'll see just a summary footnote that shows what is the liability in the Des Moines Water Works pension plan, which at year end was about $1.8 million. And then the liability owed into the IBERS plan for your employees that participated in that was about $15.7 million. The next few pages, I won't go through these in great detail. There's a lot, if you wouldn't mind going to page 37, please, Greg. There are a lot of required disclosures. Obviously, this is an area of interest to users of the financials, just kind of what benefits do you offer your employees? What kind of financial obligations do you have into the plan? So this page, I just stopped here. This kind of shows you, so again, this is specific to your standalone plan, but here just for some perspective, the total pension liability is around $63 million at the end of the year. But as we mentioned in the earlier financials, the plan holds about $61 million assets in the trust. So that difference used to be called the unfunded piece, but that difference is the net pension liability that is recorded again on your financials as liability. So your plan, if you look there, that percentage of fiduciary net position compared to that total liability, your plan is very well funded as far as financial reporting at year end, sitting there at 97%. So going through the next few pages, I won't go through these. What you're going to see is significant disclosures as Greg kind of scrolls through these. Obviously, a really key part of these pension plans is the actuarial assumptions. So you are required to include significant disclosures that just make it really transparent as far as what were the assumptions used by you and your actuary in determining what your expected future benefit costs are for your employees and retirees. So on page 41, you're going to see very similar disclosures here for the IBERS plan. So I won't go through this as well. But again, this is just showing general information. What are the contribution requirements? What do you have to do to be eligible to participate in this plan? And what is the financial impact on your financials? Note 6 at the bottom of page 45, this is the footnote that talks about your other post-employment benefits. So again, this is going to be healthcare benefits that you offer to retirees. So it's somewhat similar, obviously, in nature to pension, just meaning you're going through and analyzing what is the cost for allowing retirees to stay on the health plan. So there you'll see at year end, as we noted, that liability at year end is about $18.5 million for expected long-term costs to provide those benefits. And similar, you go through and provide disclosures on the assumptions used by the actuary determining that. The roll forward there, Greg, if you wouldn't mind going back, the roll forward there here of the screen here, you can see how the liability has changed year over year. So it did, as we noted, increase quite a bit this year, just over $3 million. Most of that was due to the change in assumptions that were used by the actuary, again, primarily from that discount rate that decreased in the market. So on page, if you could please go to page 52, Greg, So that's really the extent of the footnotes. I would usually note if there was any new footnotes that were added this year, there were none. So most of the content that you're seeing is very just consistent as far as what you would have previously presented. This is your required supplementary information. Sometimes I point you here just because this is consistent information with what we just went through in the footnotes, but sometimes visually it's easier to see these numbers kind of go versus going through the narratives. So eventually this will be a 10-year schedule, but here you see a 3-year presentation because that's how long this standard has been in effect, a 3-year summary of kind of the direction that your OPEB liability is moving for those healthcare costs. And then similar, Greg, if you could please go to the next page. Here is the same schedule for the net pension liability. Again, this will be a 10-year schedule. So again, this is just a good way to see a 10-year trend of your total pension liability in your plan. On page 56, this is one we get questions about, or people are usually interested in the financials. You show a 10-year history of contributions. So this is just good to be able to point to as far as showing that you all have historically contributed the amount that is required or recommended to contribute into the plan. So you're able to show, was there a contribution deficiency or excess into the plan based on what you as the employer paid into the trust. And then these next few pages are repeated as well for the IPERS plan. So similar, Greg, if you wouldn't mind going to page 61, again, IPERS is obviously a statewide plan that you all just, you participate in versus administer. So here on page 61, just evidence showing that you as the employer have contributed in each year what they require as far as the state requirement paying into that plan. So next I'm gonna move, Greg, if you wouldn't mind taking us to the auditor communications, please. So part of our, one of our audit requirements is to go through certain topics with the board at the conclusion of an audit, really kind of just summarizing the results of the audit and if any issues came up. So here on page one, first of all, just point you to the responsibilities and why that's key. Before the start of any and all audits, we enter into an arrangement letter. And that just reminds both us as far as obviously showing the auditing standards that we follow when we perform our work and then the responsibilities management has as it relates to the accuracy of the financial reporting information. At the bottom here, significant estimates, that's just noted. We wanna make sure you know as part of the audit, there are areas of subjectivity in the financials where management is estimating either a liability or a balance. We do take a look at those as part of the audit and just make sure they're reasonable compared to your policies, what we see in the industry, et cetera. So no issues came up there. The top of the next page, we would report if there was any audit adjustments. So when we started the audit, did any adjustments or changes came up in our work? You'll see here there were none. So that's always a positive, certainly, to be able to report that the audited financials you're looking at are consistent with the original trial balance. So that's very, that shows very highly as far as the work the finance department does in preparing for the audit, that we're not coming in and finding errors as a result of our testing, et cetera. Going on to the next page. So audits performed under government auditing standards as yours is required to be, we issue this report on internal controls. So as a reminder, the purpose of an audit is not to give an opinion on controls, nor do we, but the auditing standards do require that if we were to become aware of any material weaknesses or significant deficiencies during our work, we have an obligation to report those. There were none. So you will see just in this letter, it provides the standard definition of what those are. And it just talks about we were aware of none, but certainly we don't audit 100% of transactions. We would be camped out with Amy and Michelle probably there all year long. So there is there is the potential that deficiencies could be out there, but nothing came up during the course of our audit work. I can take a pause there. I was getting ready to go into the pension report, but before we shift gears a little bit, are there any questions on these financials or our audit itself? Okay, I'll go through the pension one. This will be quite a bit shorter, I think. As far as pension, we already have kind of talked through, you'll see here, similar unmodified or clean audit opinion. Again, no meaning the financials are presented in accordance with GAAP. On page three, we've already gone through these financials since they're incorporated into Duane Waterworks report. Again, you'll see here, assets held. Greg, on the next page, you'll see the income statement that we went through. So really the footnotes, I wasn't going to go through these because we really just went through most of them. But just so you know, I mean, again, in note one, you provide detailed disclosures on the information about the plan itself, and then significant disclosures on the investments held as well as those actuarial assumptions used in determining your net pension liability. So I will, actually, that's a good place, Greg, if you wouldn't mind going to the top of that page. You know, the one actuarial assumption that I do usually walk through with you all is that discount rate. You know, obviously it's hard to, you go through and analyze, right, how much you, what the return on your investments is going to be. This, what this is called is the sensitivity analysis. And this is always just to highlight the importance of that discount rate that you're using. What this schedule shows you is, you know, currently you're assuming that investments on a long-term basis are going to earn a 5.6% rate of return. And what this schedule simply shows you is how much the liability swings each way if that percentage were to move 1%. So, you know, again, it's just a highlight, you know, it's hard. I mean, obviously nobody has a crystal ball. That's why it's important to continue to monitor the investment performance in your plan, just because that, again, a 1% swing in those returns does have a pretty noticeable impact on the liability. Greg, if you want to go ahead and move to the auditor communications for the pension plan, this, honestly, the language in the letter is going to be very consistent. So what I'll just highlight here, I mean, we've kind of already touched on it, but again, in a pension plan, the key significant estimate areas, again, are those fair value of investments, as well as the actuarial assumptions, that those are subjective. Obviously, a lot of work is put into the analysis there, but they are estimates in the financials. And then lastly, I hadn't touched upon, you will see drafts of the management representation letter. So just as a reminder for the board, we management signs a representation letter at the conclusion of audits that confirms really two main areas: that the financials are complete and accurate to the best of their knowledge, as well as the information we were provided with during our audit. And no deficiencies came up during the pension audit either. So you won't see a letter to that effect. The last three documents, I don't usually talk through these. These are just cash receipts, disbursements reports because of the billings and collections you do for the city of Des Moines. These reports are issued. We don't usually spend much time here. They're pretty straightforward. It's just showing the cash that you collected for them and then dispersed back to them. So I'll stop there. I'm happy to go through any questions on the deliverables or the audit process itself, if there are any.
Any questions, Kristen? If not, Amy, you want to?
Yeah, I have a couple closing comments. Kristen just reviewed the pension audit, but and the regular audit report. The regular audit report will be presented to the board for approval in June, later this month. But the pension audit, we wait until July. Technically, that is approved by the pension board, which just happens to be the Des Moines Water Works board. But we do convene a special meeting for that. So I just didn't want you to be caught off guard that the pension report will not be included in the June agenda. It'll be in the July agenda. And then really lastly for me, you know, we just reviewed, we didn't review hundreds of pages of the audit, but we flipped through them. And it is an immense amount of work. And I don't think that really any a staff member in finance goes untouched by the audit. It's certainly a group effort, but Michelle Holland really does the heavy lifting. And I wanna recognize her efforts because she's a big part of A Clean Opinion. That's something for us to be very proud of. And the fact that we are well prepared when the auditors come on site. So my thanks to Michelle and her team.
Thank you, Michelle. Anything else for Kristen or her team?
Nothing for me, but kudos to Kristen and her team and Amy and Michelle and their team. Thanks for all the hard work.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Kristen and Greg.
Thank you. Yes, and I'm sorry, I should have I kept referring to him, but just, you know, Greg is our audit manager on the engagement as well. And I apologize. I should have introduced him when we started. So thank you for helping me through the presentation there.
Thank you both very much.
All right. Well, we will hop off if there are no further questions.
Thank you very much. Care, guys.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Bye. Have a good rest of your meeting.
Thanks, everyone.
All right. So we are on to item two, legal services review. I will note that the members of the Finance and Audit Committee met recently, as I think our memo here states, and discussed this. Considering the important nature of this decision, you know, selecting legal counsel and how long a decision like this could live with us, considering we've worked the same law firm for decades, you know, maybe we'll pick a different law firm and work with them for decades. So considering the long-reaching potential impacts of this decision, we want to make sure we have a thorough and appropriate process for selecting legal counsel. And so we had some initial discussions about kind of timeline for that, and I think staff has laid that out nicely. So with that, I'll let Ted take it away.
Joel, you did a great job of queuing this up. I think that the two main points from my perspective before we let Amy kind of review what we came up with. One is that we did review, and I think that the team, which includes finance and audit, and Amy and I decided that it would be appropriate to have an interview step added to the timeline of this process, something we hadn't originally included in there. And for that reason, and just to give us time with everything else that's going on, including regionalization and strategic planning and busy board member schedules, just stretch the schedule out a little bit so we could do this appropriately. We took that feedback back, and I think Amy can walk us through what we came up with here, which is probably pretty well laid out in the memo.
Amy? Yeah. I think the two points that I want to highlight there is we do think it's would be helpful if we develop an evaluation mm-hmm. matrix where we have, you know, the considerations that are important to the board in selecting legal counsel and then how we're weighting that, and have all of that process really tied up before we even distribute the proposals. The responses remain sealed. I have not opened those until that part of the process can be completed. And we'd like to look at that at our July Finance and Audit Committee meeting. And then after that, I will distribute the responses just so that we can make sure we maintain the integrity of the process. And then we will take time to review the proposals, the references, and conduct interviews, really the 3 months of August, September, and October. And then just bring the results or our comments back to Finance and Audit at the November meeting, and then present it to the board for approval November or December. So that's the timeline, which is, you know, as Ted and Joel suggested, more relaxed than what we had originally sketched out, but we think it's a good investment of time.
Sounds good. I'll add, this is the first time I'm seeing the firms that responded, and I'm pretty pleased with the list here. I was, you know, worried that given our, you know, all the involvements and potential conflicts we have, it would be tough for a lot of firms to apply. There are a lot of potential conflicts that may prevent other firms. So I'm pleased that we have a good list here. Three, you know, well-regarded local firms, two regional or national firms that have a local presence. So I think it's a good list, good starting point.
Agreed.
I don't know if Diane has any thoughts as well as
no, member of the bar. I had the same, had the same reaction. That it looks like, and I don't have any issues with moving it out. I think that we would like to get to the end of regionalization if we can, to understand the impact of that. So I think slowing it down, we've got the responses and getting the evaluation tool. Good way to go.
Anything else on that front, Ted?
No, Joel, I think that's it, unless there are questions.
The developing the evaluation matrix, will you need anything from the committee members, or what, or will staff be handling that?
I think that we will take the first swing at it, Joel, and then
of course, sure.
allow the other members, the board representatives on the committee, to review and comment.
That would be in July.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Finance and audit in July.
Makes sense.
Okay.
So we'll move to item three, CEO and general manager's comments.
Yeah, I have two comments to share today. One, we did have the opportunity last week on Friday, several of us here on Waterworks staff, to host the Secretary of Agriculture for a tour and discussion about water quality in the state of Iowa. I think that that was a worthwhile endeavor. The secretary brought his deputy and a couple of other staff to participate in the tour, and we had a good discussion about some of the challenges we face and things that are being done and things that need to be done. Graham Gillette joined us for the discussion portion. He wasn't part of the tour, but he joined us for the discussion portion, and I think it was time well spent. So hopefully we can move forward on some initiatives that we are working on. We asked for some support, in fact, some funding for some of the initiatives that we're working on, and some support just in terms of the Department of Ag's engagement and some other initiatives that we're working on. So that was a good outcome, I believe. The other thing that I will share is that Kyle sent me an email just a little bit ago advising me that the microcystin concentrations at our intake on the Des Moines River were today, for the first time this year, above the EPA's drinking water health advisory level. So sometimes they bounce around a little bit, but this 0.5 compared to the standard of 0.3, so quite a bit above. And I have to say, this is very early in the year. Usually it's late in July before we start to see microcystin concentrations that high. So pretty early onset there, not good news, but we'll keep an eye on it and keep you posted.
Hey, Ted, is that related to the heat? You said it's early.
Yes, and I would say it's also related to the low river flows. Mm-hmm. So slow moving, warm water.
Yeah, I was looking at the weather. It looks like this heat is supposed to continue this week and next week.
Yeah, we're kind of in the oven, it feels like, here for a couple of weeks. And river levels are very low. The flow on the Des Moines River today is 388 cubic feet per second. And the median flow over the last 24 years on this date was 4,000. CFS. So we're less than 10% of the median flow. You know, usually we'd be getting an inch of rain a week this time of year, and we haven't had an inch of rain in the last 6 weeks combined. So we are comfortably meeting demand today. We continue to push out our messages related to using water wisely, and if customers choose to water their grass, to please be smart about that and make sure and not overwater. We've asked them not to water on Mondays, not to water during the heat of the day, not to water the street or their driveway or other hard surfaces. I did see that the city of Waukee pushed out that same message on their social media this week, which is positive. I talked to West Des Moines and they said they're promoting the same schedule, but I haven't seen signs of that in the news or in social media, but another week of this kind of heat and dry will change the landscape, and we may need to be talking to the wholesale customers about pushing that message harder, and we'll see where we ultimately end up. But we could certainly end up in a place where, in the depths of a drought, we are asking people to limit their lawn watering.
Ted, do we, and I really like the public outreach we've been doing on social media and elsewhere. I think that's been effective. What about reaching out to property management associations, other business groups, associations like that? I drive around West Des Moines, you got to imagine some of those office parks account for a good chunk of the irrigation. Do we talk to kind of property management groups?
You know, we have not historically done that, Joel, and that's a great idea. Jennifer was actually asking me a similar question either early today or yesterday, just about should we reach out to the R&Rs and, you know, some of those management companies that have these huge campuses with so many acres of grass and just let them know. I think our discussion was we should probably do that through the water utilities that serve them directly so that we don't step on toes there. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of our suburban customers, asking their customers not to irrigate is like asking a retailer to close on Black Friday, right? It's just
right.
Their money. So,
but I thought, Ted, we were not initially asking them not to irrigate, but doing the staggering.
That's true, Diane. Right now we haven't asked anyone to reduce or restrict usage. We are asking them to schedule their usage according to a schedule that we have published and that most of the suburban communities have adopted or embraced. And I think it could be, Joel's suggestion there to reach out to these management companies could be a good first step so that if we have to go further, we've made the contacts and then mm-hmm. they know that we're trying to, do the best we can. But with 300 CFS in the river the first week of June, I am worried about what it will look like in August.
Yeah.
Well, Ted, let me clarify there. I see your point about, maybe we don't reach out to the Hubbles and R&Rs directly because we don't want to step on toes. I'm trying to remember what the organizations are and looking for them now, but, there are, I believe, like property management associations, the industry, the trade groups, that put on the local conventions and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like those would be good places to reach out because then we're not reaching to, and then we're not talking specifically to a West Des Moines property owner, but an association that deals with property managers throughout the metro. So I think that might be a good fertile ground for outreach.
Yeah, I understand now what you're saying. And if you could direct us to those, that would be great. Otherwise, I'm sure we can find them.
Sure.
But they're not someone who I've dealt with in the past, but maybe from a backflow perspective or something like that we have. But we will do some looking into that and see. That seems like it would be a good constituency to reach out to.
Sure.
But I have a question too about, we've talked about, scheduling irrigation so that everybody isn't doing it Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but how do you assure compliance on that? Or if you're going to do that, not move everybody off of Monday to Tuesday, then you have a new issue on Tuesday. How do you go about organizing that?
Diane, we haven't taken it to that step because we're trying to enforce odd even. You'd literally have to go to every address and make sure they're watering on the right day. We haven't gone to that. That's a part of our voluntary program.
But voluntary means that I just choose to go from Monday to Tuesday?
Well, so the program says that if you have an even numbered address, you go to Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And if you have an odd numbered address, you go to Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. So it provides that direction.
Do we know whether that has made any difference at all, or?
We don't know yet. I mean, we've been delivering that message for a number of years, and that's a schedule that we put together. Amy helped me 5 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, I would say at least. It's difficult to know what has, if that has made an impact or if it's just the weather patterns. You know, we have seen it minimize the peak day, but it's difficult to isolate what the cause is.
Well, it might be interesting to just ask our suburban customers who have those big campuses to look at the, to do a kind of a spot survey of evens and odds and just ask them, which day are you doing your irrigation?
You know, I was able to visit with Christina Murphy a little bit about that today and asked if there was any way that they could just look at some of those campuses and see if they've started irrigating yet, first of all, and try to determine. You know, it's ironic that a lot of those, the buildings on those campuses are still empty or, you know, partially.
I know. I mean, it just seems like a more organized approach to that. And there are not hundreds of them. I mean, there are, you can identify those big campuses and maybe get them into a staggered irrigation schedule if they're not doing that now.
Yeah. I think we can do that. And I think what Joel has offered here is trying to identify the associations that they're members of and reach out to them too. So I think we've got a couple of opportunities there that we can work on to see. Ultimately, you know, our program is voluntary in the first couple of stages. And then ultimately it goes into a mandatory prohibition.
Yeah, it seems like there's a better way from voluntary to a prohibition that we should be able to do, because I mean, if I were had one of those campuses, I would much rather stagger and understand the importance of that and just change that than realize I was putting at risk going to having none at all.
Right. Yeah, I will say, Diane, that it's a good idea. Our irrigation management plan has not matured to that point yet.
Yeah.
This may be a good year to work on that.
Yeah. I mean, if it does, we're going to need it pretty quickly. So I think trying to figure out how to do that. And like I said, it can't be all that long of a list of those great big campuses that are irrigating. And if we need to go through there, if we need to go through West Des Moines or Waukee or whoever, we should do it. Yeah. We should call them together and say, hey, we're going to try to figure this out.
You know, we've certainly called them together and offered them the proposed schedule and asked them to push that out. We have not taken the step of going to their customers with them and trying to get them to implement. And that feels like the next step.
Do you feel they've been very receptive or cooperative with, you know, promoting our proposed schedule?
I feel like they have. I feel like most of them, not only the schedule, Joel, but even the multi-step water shortage plan, most of them have adopted that. And I don't know that they've all adopted it by council resolution or whatever, but most of them are in support of a water shortage plan that starts out as a voluntary plan and then ultimately becomes a mandatory plan. So we've had, that was several years ago that we worked through that process, but we have not worked with them to reach out to their customers.
Yeah, and maybe we do need to do a survey of these big ones and say, you're an odd, when are you irrigating?
Yeah, and if they've even heard about it.
Yeah.
Even aware. You know, one thing that we did do, Diane, and we did pretty aggressively for a couple of years in a row, is we worked with the irrigation companies that manage all these irrigation systems and set the systems up every spring and winterize them every fall. Yeah. And we said, look, this is what we want you to do.
Yeah.
When you go out, we want you to eliminate irrigation on Monday, and based on odd or even, this is what we want you to do. And I wasn't involved in those meetings, but from what I heard, they were open-minded to that.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have a good way to measure
compliance.
Uptake or compliance.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think, you know, voluntary things without any, you know, without any enforcement are difficult things to do, because it's like, oh, well, yeah, but that would take some time for me to reset that. And they're not doing anything. So,
yeah,
no big deal. I'll let somebody else do it.
Right. No, I understand. We have been, you know, kind of waving that flag for a few years. So hopefully some of them have taken it up. And, you know, frankly, once in a while, it takes an event to change.
Yeah. Behavior. Well, this might be a good year to get going on that.
Well, this may be the event.
Yeah.
But it's been very comfortable thus far. We're fortunate there.
Good. And maybe they are. Maybe it's like Amy said, maybe they did it, and that's why we are not having issues. Who knows?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't know. Nothing else from me, Joel.
Okay, I should pull my agenda back up. Item 4, public comments. Do we have any members of the public who would like to speak? Don't see anyone, and see none. I think that is all on our agenda. Anything else before we adjourn, Ted?
Yeah. Ted, I have a quick question. Do we have a meeting tomorrow morning?
Amy, can you tell me what the traffic has been there?
Yes, Diane, you do not. Staff is still meeting, Ted. So you do. Diane is off the hook.
Oh, okay.
I can do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All righty.
All right. With that, okay. Do we have a motion to adjourn? My fellow board member here.
I move we adjourn.
Second. All right. Thanks for your time, all.
Yep.
Bye, guys.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.